From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Roman Church's recent response to charges of sexually abusing children, scapegoating gay priests, and also the institution of celibacy is not only morally reprehensible, but I think expands the web of victimization and needs to be addressed as vehemently as the originating charges.
Preying on children, priests, and pedophilia. Today, we'll look at the biggest crisis to rock the Catholic Church, some would say in centuries. Then, Iraq, Big Oil, and Dick Cheney. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. A car bomb exploded outside the U.S. Embassy in Lima, Peru, late last night, killing 9 people, injuring at least 30. The blast came just 3 days before President Bush is set to arrive in Peru for a brief round of talks. Bush is heading to Mexico today for the beginning of a 4-day Latin American tour that'll end in El Salvador on Sunday. That's the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was killed by right-wing death squads, among them those trained by the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. Meanwhile, a march against the Free Trade Area of the Americas and Plan Colombia in Quito, Ecuador, was attacked on Wednesday by security guards and police on their way to the American Embassy. 2 protesters were shot by security guards and police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd. Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films and the Independent Media Center was there and filed this video and audio report.
A peaceful march of 200 people left the Salesiana University in downtown Quito in the early afternoon yesterday, on its way to the U.S. Embassy. The protest was called by an international coalition of groups against the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas and Plan Colombia. The march wound through the streets of downtown Quito, chanting and carrying colorful signs and banners from countries across Latin America. Militant but peaceful, the protesters painted graffiti but did not engage in property destruction. As we approached the World Trade Center, the protesters pulled down the American flag, and one protester smashed a surveillance camera. A security guard pulled his gun, and as the crowd retreated, opened fire, wounding 2 protesters. One was shot in the leg and was rushed to a nearby hospital. The other received a minor wound in the foot. The protesters negotiated with the police to continue the march to the U.S. Embassy, peacefully, with a police escort. But in 2 blocks, the escort ran ahead, turned, and began firing tear gas into the crowd. Protesters responded with rocks, and we retreated back to the university. The wounded protesters are both in good condition now, and local and international human rights cases have already been filed against the security guards and the police. The protest and police violence comes at a tense time in Ecuador, on the heels of a general strike in the North Amazon in which 5 protesters were killed by police, and in the midst of a major mobilization against privatization. From Quito, Ecuador, this is Rick Rowley reporting for Democracy Now!
And you are listening to Democracy Now! Continuing the headlines, the Bush administration has settled on a complex set of military tribunal regulations to be applied to prisoners being held in the so-called war on terror. The new rules give prosecutors more leeway than they would have in criminal courts. For example, hearsay or secondhand evidence can be used in the new tribunals despite the fact it's barred in ordinary criminal trials and court-martials. The Pentagon reported yesterday, but then retracted, what it thought was a chilling discovery pointing to the global reach of the Al-Qaeda network. In early afternoon, officials said a handheld global positioning system, GPS device, that belonged to a U.S. soldier killed in Somalia in 1993 had been found with a dead Al-Qaeda fighter in the Shaikot Valley of Afghanistan. Army officials were so confident about the discovery, Air Force Brigadier General John Rosa said at the Pentagon that they had informed the soldier's family. Later in the day, the Pentagon said it had been mistaken. The name G. Gordon was scratched on the found GPS unit. That led officials to believe it had belonged to Army Master Sergeant Gary Gordon, who died in the 93 firefight in Somalia. However, a check of the serial number on the device showed it was sold to the Army 5 years after Gordon's death. The Pentagon now says the GPS unit marked G. Gordon once belonged to a helicopter pilot who resembles Watergate figure G. Gordon Liddy. That pilot gave the device to another flyer who participated in Operation Anaconda and lost the unit on the battlefield. Sergeant Gordon was a sniper in 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, more commonly known as Delta Force, a top-secret special operations unit. And the New York Times is reporting the U.S. is considering sending troops across the Afghan border into Pakistan to capture or kill al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters believed to have found sanctuary there. The plan was disclosed to the New York Times in an interview with the commander of American forces in Afghanistan.
Christian cannons have fired at my days, with a warning beneath the holy blaze, and bow to our authority, say the canons of Christianity. Oh, the children will be sent to schools. Minds of clay are molded to the rules. Learn to fear all of eternity. Warn the canons of Christianity.
Canons of Christianity. Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, co-host of Democracy Now! Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all our listeners, and I'm glad to be back after a short absence here to finish this book on the World Trade Center environmental problems.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. Also, important story you have in the Daily News today about the testing of asbestos levels at the World Trade Center site. We'll talk about that later, but right now we're going to start off with an issue that is rocking the foundations of the Catholic Church today. 1 in 11 American Catholics say they've personal knowledge of child sexual abuse by a priest. This according to the first national survey of Roman Catholic opinion since revelations of abuse cases began sweeping the country this winter. The scandal has damaged the credibility of American bishops. The approval rating of their leadership plummeted from 85% in October to 68% in March. The foundations of the U.S. Catholic Church being rocked by the controversy over and cover-up over the sexual abuse of children by priests. It's a national controversy many believe will seriously undermine the moral authority of the Church. Yesterday, Pope John Paul made his first comment on the wave of church pedophilia, writing that he was profoundly hurt by Roman Catholic priests involved in what he called, quote, the most grievous form of evil, partly in response to the recent scandals. A Vatican department is preparing a document on, quote, psychological profiling to block men who have potential sexual problems from entering the priesthood. Even President Bush weighed in yesterday, saying he's confident the church will clean up its business and do the right thing. But not many people believe that's going to be easy. And we're going to turn right now to Eugene Kennedy. He was a Maryknoll priest for 22 years, wrote the book The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He was commissioned by the National Council of Catholic Bishops in the early 1970s to coordinate a psychological study of the American Catholic priesthood. When his study led to conclusions contrary to those that were hoped for, the study was not given official approval. We're joined on the phone right now by Eugene Kennedy. Welcome to Democracy Now! Well, can you just start off by laying out what you see as the major issue that the Catholic Church has to deal with right now?
Well, I believe that the issue has been stated rather well by you. This is a crisis not so much of Catholicism as a church. Even the polls in Boston, which has been a center of an explosive center of for this pedophilia problem in recent weeks, the people make a clear distinction between the Catholic Church as their spiritual home and the body of beliefs which they profess. and the church as an organization, that is an administrative structure that cares for all the secular, if you will, details of it. This is not a crisis of the church as a center of belief in the sacraments. It is a major crisis. Tom Ridge would have to give it a condition red for the church as an organization. And I believe that the leaders of the church were ill-advised to act more like heads of an organization and less like pastors of a flock when this problem became quite evident a generation ago. I believe that they followed the advice of lawyers, insurers, and PR people. The insurers and lawyers, of course, are interested in protecting their own assets, and they put upon this response, therefore, the kind of response that Ewan Carbide had after Beaufort, which was to protect its assets and put this tragic event. There you will recall 4,000 people died from a gas leak at one of its chemical plants in India. Here we have a comparable desolation in the predatory behavior of priests with those who thought they could trust them, not only the victims themselves, but their families, parents, and others. And the strategy to try to deal with this case by case and diocese by diocese and to handle it as a corporation would has been a tragic mistake. Bishops are called to be pastors of flocks who are not so much concerned about protecting assets as they are concerned about protecting the flock, especially its youngest members. I believe
Eugene Kennedy, if I can interrupt for 1 second, I'd just like to focus in on a particular point that you raise in your book where you talk about, and you've alluded to it, you talk about this shadow church that exists, the bureaucracy of the church. And you say the bureaucracy is a shadow church that reflects less the glory of God than the cunning of the world, less the sense of eternity than of drowning in time. Isn't part of the problem is not just a question of this of the existence of this enormous bureaucracy, but also that it is an extremely hierarchical, dictatorial bureaucracy that is really beyond sort of public inspection. Your normal government bureaucracy, at least you have freedom of information requests. There's a certain responsibility to be accountable to the public in the inner workings of the institution. But in the church, you have extreme secrecy in the operations of the inner workings of the church, and basically the bishop or the of any particular diocese really runs a dictatorship of sorts, doesn't he?
You're pointing out something that was responded to by Vatican Council II. And what really an end has been put to the hierarchical model, which you just described as a top-down operation. In Vatican II, long before great American industries understood that the hierarchical model, which they had adopted actually from the Army after the Civil War and structuring themselves, no longer worked in the space information age, the bishops gathered at Vatican II, sensing great changes in the world, returned to the formulation on which the church was established as a college of apostles. That is, not a top-down, one person gives the orders, but a group whose members were equal, who shared in the responsibility for preaching the church and caring for its members. That was restored by Vatican II, and therefore restored to bishops in their own diocese the authority that they had and with which called upon them then, rather, to deliberate in relationship to their people and various groupings, and senate of their priests and councils of advisors, so that the principle of collegiality would be spread down to the lowest levels of the church. The present pope, great man that he is in many other ways, has tried abruptly to reverse this course and restore hierarchy as a form. This has not succeeded and has been shipwrecked on the shoals of this terrible scandal. So what has come to an end is this hierarchical formulation with all the secrecy that it can, in fact, engender and feeds off, and the idea that things can be done in a top-down manner. You are going to see a restoration of the spirit of collegiality. This will have a great effect on the next gathering to elect a pope, the conclave as it is called, that will be called when this pope dies. Pressure about this has built up all over the world, and it's unsatisfactory response on the part of the bureaucratic elements of the church. And so we can look for a reshaping and a reformulation of the church in a far more open way as one of the results of this. This is not a lesson the present tragedy, nor make the measure of the mistaken judgments any less either.
But in terms of the move, as you expressed, from Vatican II to attempt to bring some more collective decision making, the reality is, though, that throughout virtually every diocese that's been reviewed so far in these recent allegations, the same policy existed. Which was a policy.
That's not a policy of the Vatican. That is a policy of American business. You must understand that the advice for this did not come out of any Vatican manual. This came out of the way that big corporations ordinarily handle crises. They have the same advisors. Those are lawyers, insurers, and public relations advisors. This is a tragic choice to follow what we might call the wisdom of the world. A good example, as I mentioned before, being Union Carbide's effort to try to contain, minimize its losses, and retain the integrity of its properties after that tragic loss of life. This is not something that is a function of the church. This is a tragic assumption of the advice that has misled the church into being more like an organization than as a church that is committed to the spiritual welfare of its people.
Eugene Kennedy, I know you have to leave, but I was wondering if you could stay on for a few more minutes, because we have another guest in the studio with us, and I was very interested in hearing a dialogue between you. She is Reverend Pat Bumgartner. She is a pastor at Metropolitan Community Church in New York. MCC is the largest gay and lesbian organization in the world. You wanted to be a Catholic priest, is that right?
I did. I studied at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago and was part of the women's ordination movement in the United States. But when I moved to New York, I actually discerned that my inclination toward the priesthood was accurate and found a community that, in fact, called me to service.
So what happens for a woman who tries to become a priest? How does it work?
Not much. You can get an education, at least here in the United States, you can get an education because canon law doesn't prohibit the education of women, but you can't go on to pursue the steps toward ordination.
Mm-hmm. What has been your reaction to this very serious crisis that the not only the church is facing,
right,
today? Of course, the greatest crisis is faced by the children
right,
who are
right,
preyed upon.
Well, I would agree with Mr. Kennedy in the sense that the first issue is the children and the people who have been victimized by the church, and not only their pastoral well-being, but their emotional and physical well-being. But I also think that the Catholic Church, in the United States at least, has failed to step up to the plate and take responsibility for what has happened within its borders. Here in our country, for example, and apparently with the Vatican sanction, the response seems to focus on, well, let's scapegoat gay priests, or let's scapegoat the institution of celibacy. Let's blame this problem on people, for example, gay men, who are already seen as evil or vile in our social structure. Let's blame them for this problem, and let's say that they weren't really priests to begin with, and then we'll get the public all stirred up about that and take their focus off of the real issue, which is pedophilia and has nothing to do with sexual orientation or gender or any of the things that are being lifted up here. Takes our focus off the real issue and allows the church really not to deal. Last night, the cardinal here in New York stepped up to the microphone and basically said nothing. He said, you know, that he would encourage people who came to him with problems to report to the authorities. Well, that's like a nothing response. What is he going to do about the issue within his own borders?
And also, it seems to me, in terms of the cardinals, the cardinal of New York's statement, the problem that I have is that some of the very prelates now who are making these statements were the ones who effectively did not prevented criminal prosecutions of the people who are involved. So rather than begin with a self-criticism of their own behavior, they begin with an attack on clearly pedophilia as a crime and as a sickness in some individuals cuts across all kinds of lines, and you would expect that some priests would be. But the question then becomes is, what does the church do about it, and how does it deal with crimes within its ranks? It seems to me that the church is acting as if almost it's above the law, at least criminal law. It's willing to pay $1 billion in civil damages to quiet these cases.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, the real issue in terms of pedophilia is one that, as you say, is a social problem. It's not one that's limited to the ranks of the church. But it's also a problem that we know, at least that we can say very little factually about. Nobody is really certain about the originating causes or the treatment. One thing that we seem to be pretty certain of is that everything we do to people who practice pedophilia does not change them, does not alter the situation, does not rehabilitate them. The church needs to take a really serious look at that and be engaging some of the best minds available on this subject, because outside of the victims, the child victims and the familial victims, there are also the people perpetrating these crimes, and how do they get better? And the church seems to exemplify no concern for those folks at all.
I wanted to ask Eugene Kennedy about celibacy. I know that Reverend Pat Baumgartner, you say that celibacy has nothing to do with this, and it's being raised in the wrong way now. But I was very interested in going back and looking at some of what you've written, Eugene Kennedy, talking about the origins of celibacy, that it's been a requirement since the 10th century when Pope St. Gregory the Great forced it on clergy.
Yeah, actually, it was Hildebrand was the pope. It was Gregory the Sixth. Just to edit myself here a little bit.
Okay, but to end the abuse of their passing on church lands to their heirs. But
right.
What about celibacy? I'd like to hear what you have to say about it, and then Reverend Baumgartner.
Well, I agree with many of her observations. I believe that celibacy is not the cause of this problem any more than marriage is the cause of divorce. What has occurred, however, is if you leave any system unexpected and you do not ask yourself the first question that should have occurred to the bishops, why is this problem arising among our priests, and you do not seek to understand that, painful as that investigation might have been, then you're going to end up coping with the results of something you have never fully understood or been able to admit to yourself. That is the tragic situation with all its human toll, as the Reverend has indeed pointed out. And now, as I would like to second something that she said, this looking about for scapegoats, for example, in saying that this is a problem brought to the church by homosexuals is an outrageous kind of accusation that reflects the lack of information, the lack of willingness of the bishops to look into this situation. Cardinal Burnet, the late Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, attempted in the mid-80s to get the bishops to initiate a program of research to answer that question, why is this happening and what can we do about it? But he was never able to get it through the bureaucracy. It was a great frustration for him. The question is no more advanced at this point, and yet if we are committed to the truth, and if the truth will make us free, it is not too late in the day for the bishops to put aside the advice that does make them look, as they certainly seem now, much like the agents of corporate America defending itself rather than the pastors of a flock that needs their spiritual leadership and comfort, and say, we will take a look at this. We're unafraid to find out what happened, and we invite our people to join us. I believe the prejudice against your other guest becoming a priest in the Roman Catholic Church is also a function of the wound I try to write about in that book, which is all flows from a distorted image of the human person that the church has adopted, in which they pit elements of the human person, body and soul, against each other, flesh and spirit. That's not healthy. The unhealthiness of this particular situation is one of the fruits of that. So too has been the almost universal unfortunate and undeserved feelings of guilt that ordinary people have merely for being human and being sexual in nature.
Well, the Vatican now is talking about beginning a psychological profile process, a weeding out process for priests. Would you think that this is in the right direction, or should there be more psychological profiling and review of the bishops who are making who have made these erroneous decisions in the past? And do you agree that some of these bishops should resign?
We've already done a psychological study of the bishops. We did that at Loyola University after we finished the study of the priests. It was very interesting because we found that the most important motivation for most bishops was to please the Pope and to be approved by him. This is a very dangerous predominant motivation to have in an organization like the Church. It is like the myth of Parzival, which I discuss in the book, where Parzival comes to try to heal the Grail King, who has suffered a grievous sexual wound, and finds that the members of his court all remain silent and will not say anything for fear that they will incur disfavor from him. That's exactly the situation we have. Incidentally, Parzival cures the Grail King by asking a simple human question, and that question is, what is it that ails you? By the very asking of it, the king is healed of a sexual wound. I believe in the Church, as Reverend Baumgartner says, all we have to really do is ask that truthfully. What is it that ails you? There are lots of procedures we can follow to find the answer. But the question must first be raised undefensively, ready to find out the situation. Until that time, the Grail King, the Church, if you will remain uncomfortable and imprisoned by its own sexual wound.
I want to thank you, Eugene Kennedy, for joining us, author of The Unhealed Wound, The Church and Human Sexuality. He was a priest for 22 years and has lived for more than a quarter of a century now as a married man and headed the psychological panel of a multidisciplinary study of the American Catholic priesthood. We're going to stay with Reverend Pat Baumgartner when we come back here on Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Dante's pilgrim finds Peter Lavini on the seventh level of the Inferno. Like Judas Iscariot, he died by hanging. But Judas and Peter Lavini are linked in Dante by the avarice he saw in them. In fact, avarice and hanging are linked in the medieval mind. And this is the earliest known depiction of the crucifixion, carved on an ivory box in Gaul about AD 400. It includes the death by hanging of Judas, his face upturned to the branch that suspends him. Here he is again on the doors of the Benevento Cathedral, hanging, this time with his bowels falling out. And this plate from a 15th century edition of the Inferno, Pietro Lavinia's body hangs from a bleeding tree. I will not belabor the obvious parallel with Judas Iscariot, but Dante Alighieri needed no drawn illustration. It is his genius to make Pietro Lavinia, now in hell, speak in strained hisses and coughing sibilants as though...
Let My Home Be My Gallows, featuring Sir Anthony Hopkins from Hannibal CD. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk about the crisis that is rocking the foundations of the Catholic Church in the United States today, and it is the issue of pedophilic priests, of priests preying on children. We are joined by Reverend Pat Baumgartner, who is a pastor at the Metropolitan Community Church in New York. It's the Metropolitan Community Church is the largest gay and lesbian organization in the world. She would have been a Catholic priest if they would have let her. Also on the phone with us from Chicago, Sheila Daly, co-director of Call to Action, an organization of Catholics working for reform in the Catholic Church. Sheila Daly, what are your demands?
Well, among our issues over the last 25 years, we have been advocating that the Church look at ordaining women and at ordaining married men as well, and making celibacy an option for priests. This particular crisis, I think, makes it even more desperately needed that we look at those issues as a Church as a whole, and that our hierarchy really open itself up to listening to the voices of lay people who are in the parishes, who are the ones who are suffering most immediately from the results of this crisis, I think. And it's not that we can eliminate pedophilia by ordaining women and married men. We know that this issue cuts across the society more widely than just clergy. But the church is not serving its people well by narrowing the priesthood down simply to those who are willing to adopt a celibate life. And as we're seeing, that's on the surface. There's many men who are not living up to that that vow.
Well, Sheila Daly, I'd like to ask you if you have some idea how this crisis is being dealt with at the parish level, at the Catholic school level, what the impact is. I'm interested, for instance, how Catholic school teachers in Catholic schools are explaining this crisis to the children in those schools, and what the grassroots level, what this has done to how people are looking at the church as an institution.
Well, I think some places are beginning to initiate conversations in their parishes. I know there is a parish in Wellesley, Massachusetts, that immediately after this broke began conversations after the masses on Sunday, and that has evolved into quite an aggressive approach to these issues there. To my knowledge, in the school system at this point, it's very sporadic how it's being dealt with. I can't speak to that very well.
I wanted to ask Reverend Pat Baumgartner about the issue. We're hearing a lot about pedophilic priests going after boys. What about girls? Are they just not being paid attention to, or are they not being abused?
Well, I think obviously socially what gets people more stirred up is the abuse of little boys than the abuse of little girls, because if you read the statistics in the United States, at least, a minimum of 25% of every girl in this country is abused by somebody in her immediate relational circle. So that's been going on for a long time, and obviously hands aren't being waved in the air over that, so boys kind of stoke the flames here. But I do want to say that pedophilia, in terms of pedophilia, it does apply equally in terms of boys and girls, and it has nothing to do with whether a priest is gay or straight, whether they pick boy children or girl children. The issue is children and what gets stirred up there for the adult that's involved in this activity. And it would be very interesting if the church would just open the door and look at abuse across the board. It's not only children that are being abused, I think. There are adults that are being abused. There are sexual liaisons going on between adults that have to do with unequal power relationships. And I think that it needs to look at that scandal across the board.
Just looking at some figures, according to Georgetown University Center for Applied Research, there are 45,699 Catholic priests in the United States today. Estimates of analysis of celibacy in the priesthood based on 1,500 cases. This is by a man named Sipe, who wrote A Secret World, Sexuality and the Search for Celibacy. 2% of American Catholic priests are pedophiles, adults who sexually abuse children. Another 4% are drawn to adolescents. What do you think of these figures?
Well, again, I think those figures are probably conservative in terms of people who are acting out sexually. But I also want to restate my objection to linking celibacy with this discussion, because I don't think celibacy has anything to do with whether people act out sexually or not, and certainly whether they abuse people or not. And I understand when the woman from Chicago talks about all the issues facing the church right now and the need to deal with all these crises, but it's really important not to confuse the issue and not to misalign the focus here.
And what do you think needs to be done specifically about the current crisis in terms of reforms within the church to be able to bring back confidence among Catholics around the country?
Interestingly enough, at least in the United States, the bishops issued guidelines back in the 1990s. I think the title of those guidelines were called Restoring Trust. And I don't know if they're really following those guidelines or not, but it seems to me that one thing that should be done immediately is that any person that's accused of any kind of sexual abuse needs to be removed from an environment where they can have contact with anybody that stokes the flame of that kind of abusive behavior. So, for example, if a priest is accused of molesting a child, then the answer is not shifting him to a new parish. The answer is removing him from an environment where he's going to have contact with children and getting him into some kind of immediate psychiatric treatment and evaluating what the issue is. The answer isn't publicly defaming him until you know what's really going on here. The issue is dealing with the problem and making people safe.
I'm looking at a column by Ellen Goodman, Scandal in the Boston Archdiocese. The Boston Globe did this expose. I'm not sure of how you pronounce the priest's name, Gagan.
That's how I've been saying it.
But it's also interesting in hearing Eugene Kennedy talk, comparing the church to a corporation and looking how it's functioning and covering up a scandal within as opposed to the kind of crimes that we're discussing. She says, if you listen closely, you can sometimes hear the citizens of two scandals speaking the same language. In Houston, men and women who lost their jobs and their retirement savings as Enron collapsed have often used a vocabulary more familiar to the spiritual than secular. I had faith in the company, they say. Now the institution at the center of a different scandal is one that deals not in energy but in souls. It's the Catholic Church, or simply the Church, as it's called in Boston. And then she details the unfolding, and if people weren't aware of the story of the priest, it's not so much the story of the priest and his crimes against children, but then what the hierarchy did right up to Bernard Law, who is the archbishop in Boston. Gagan was transferred like bad debts to offshore corporations, only each time Gagan got a new parish and a fresh crop of boys. He was treated by doctors, some of whom were as, quote, independent of the diocese, as Arthur Anderson accountants were of Enron. And he was offered the prayers of the cardinal. Yours has been an effective life of ministry, sadly impaired by illness. God bless you, Jack. Now we know that he was not just one rotten apple. The archdiocese settled child molestation claims against at least 70 priests over the past 10 years. That's 70 priests in a branch office that has only 650 active priests in all. And it goes on from there.
But, you know, one of the interesting things about this issue of functioning like a corporation, it's not quite functioning like a corporation, because any corporation that lost millions of dollars in civil suits as a result of activities of their employees, one would fire those employees.
Cut its losses, yes.
Or the shareholders would eventually find out in the losses of the company. But here the church has just eaten hundreds of millions of dollars that could have been spent in new schools, that could have been spent in other social programs, but has just paid out an estimated $1 billion in civil suits, and then kept all of these priests in their places without any kind of indictments or law enforcement activity for their crimes.
In the case of this man, Gagan, more than 130 people have come forward claiming he fondled or raped them between 1962 and 1995. Bernard Law, the Archbishop of Boston, apologized for his inaction. Gagan was convicted January 18th in the first of three child sex abuse cases. And there have been scores of priests who have gone to jail. It's not as if none have gone to jail. But right now, in terms of what has to be done, and in terms of this idea of the crisis that is shaking the foundations of the Catholic Church, where do you see this going?
Well, I disagree just a little bit with Mr. Kennedy, who was on earlier. I don't think that the average person going to church can distinguish between what he called an administrative crisis and a pastoral care crisis. I think there really will be a shakeup of people who are able and willing to find their spiritual home in the Roman Church, for example. And I think that the Roman Church has a very, very big pastoral care problem beyond the boundaries of the immediate people affected by this abuse scandal. And I don't know where you start with that kind of thing, because there's a big credibility gap here. You know, the issue isn't just dealing with these priests. The issue does become, as our guest from Chicago was suggesting, the wider credibility of the church and what we refer to, I think, a lot of times as the old boys club or the old boys network. Like Bernard Law, to this day, insists that he's the best person to handle this crisis because of how intimately involved he's been in it. Well, any place I know, that would be the best reason to remove him from handling that crisis.
Right now, the Catholic Church has major decisions to make. You have the Archbishop of New York, Edward Egan, talking about what he'll do. But as you said at the beginning of this program, he broke his silence. He said that molestation by priests was an abomination, sexual abuse not just immoral but also illegal, but has yet to say that, in fact, the church would turn over the priests who have been accused to the DA's office. Do you think they should be? And what about the issue of false accusations?
Well, I think the issue of false accusations is a serious issue. And I think, you know, one of the things that we supposedly go by in this country is innocent until proven guilty. And we could question that presumption, but at least it's on the books. I think that the Catholic Church does need to allow an independent type investigator into its ranks to see what's going on in each case and to ferret out the facts. I do not believe, and I don't think the public believes, that the church is capable at this point of investigating its own.
Sheila Daly, what about this issue of how the of to what degree the church can deal with its own problems? Is your group calling for the resignation of some of these bishops, or what kinds of reforms do you see necessary?
Well, certainly at this point, the credibility of the bishops involved is at stake, and resignation might be appropriate. But more fundamentally, I think on the issue of reporting sexual abuse to the proper authorities, I think our clergy need to be obligated to do that. Our church needs to be obligated to do that, just in the way that any other professional organization, teachers, social workers, have a legal obligation to do that. It doesn't mean that they are guilty. It means that the proper authorities who are trained to do those kinds of investigations can look into the incident and determine whether there is guilt. There are enough evidence to warrant taking that person to trial. To see our church as somehow above the law in this respect, I think, is a bad mistake. And it's led to what we've seen. The bishops have put out guidelines and you know, back in the early 90s, they studied this issue, and we all thought that they had taken steps to prevent this from happening again. And now it's even worse than it was then. I think the credibility of the church to correct itself is lost at this point. And the hierarchy needs to allow into its decision-making process, needs to allow light into those decision-making processes, and involve people on the grassroots level, the laity, and many, many good priests who are out there who now are under a cloud of suspicion because who knows who has been reassigned to ministry in our church who has a history of abuse. So there's this sense of distrust.
Reverend Baumgartner, finally, on this issue, we hear the Pope talking about psychological profiling. Is this going to lead to even further setbacks for gay men and lesbians who want to be in the Catholic Church?
I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of psychological profiling. While the church scapegoats gay men for its current problem of pedophilia, we have to raise the question, okay, what are you profiling for? And what's the profile of a pedophile? And I don't think the church has a good answer to that question. The church wants to look at people who have gay orientation or who have gender identity questions, and that will not solve the problem. That will just scapegoat a whole group of people who might otherwise be well-qualified priests and, in fact, be more harmful not only to those individuals but to the institution itself.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Reverend Pat Baumgartner is with the Metropolitan Community Church, MCC, which is the largest gay and lesbian organization in the world. And we've been speaking in Chicago with Sheila Daly, who is co-director of Call to Action, which is an organization of Catholics working for reform in the Catholic Church. When we come back, we will switch gears and we'll be talking about Big Oil, Dick Cheney, and the bombing of Iraq. Stay with us.
Last night, people. I heard heaven's choir rejoicing.
Infamous Angel from Iris DeMent in Kansas City. Thank you, Iris. And it's great to be back on KKFI, by the way, one of the many community radio stations that air Democracy Now! Around the country. As we turn now to the issue of Big Oil, Dick Cheney, and the bombing of Iraq. Yesterday, we aired a landmark debate between the former director of the CIA, James Woolsey, former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, and Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. The focus of the show was, will the U.S. intensify attacks on Iraq? They have been bombing Iraq for the last 10 years. Well, today we're going to continue on that theme, but take a close look at the Bush administration, Big Oil, and Iraq. Dick Cheney has just wrapped up his 11-nation tour of Arab countries as he's tried to drum up support for what the White House calls action against Iraq. And we're joined right now by Stephen Pelletier, professor emeritus at the U.S. Army War College and author of a recent book called Iraq and the International Oil System. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Let's start off with why you believe the U.S. would be bombing Iraq. Does it have to do with oil?
It does have to do with oil, but you have to understand the context in which it does. It isn't that the United States needs to physically possess the oil of Iraq. It's that the United States has to have the usufruct. It has to have the control over that oil. Because, one, if it doesn't have control over the oil, it doesn't control OPEC, and therefore it can't determine what oil prices will be worldwide. And along with that, if it doesn't control Iraqi oil, if the Iraqis control it, the Iraqis will make themselves into a regional superpower, and that will clash with U.S. interests in the Gulf.
Could you tell us a little bit about Dick Cheney and his particular relations to oil and Iraq over the past several years before he became vice president?
Cheney did not have much interest in oil until just before he became the vice president. After he retired as defense secretary, he went to Halliburton, which is one of the big corporations in the world that manufactures oil drilling equipment. So he has a very definite connection to big oil through Halliburton, but it was a connection that he established quite late, and he severed his connection with Halliburton in order to take up the job as vice president.
But in terms of some reports recently, for instance, from the Financial Times of London, talks about Cheney as a CEO of Halliburton overseeing $23.8 million in business contracts for the sale of oil industry equipment and services to Iraq through two subsidiaries, Dresser Rand and Ingersoll Dresser Pump, which now that a few years later he is attempting to organize a new coalition for expanded activities to overthrow Saddam Hussein, is it might seem in some eyes at least a huge contradiction or hypocrisy that a few years ago his subsidiaries were doing business with Iraq and now he's trying to overthrow Saddam.
Well, you're right about the connection. There was the connection, and Halliburton was dealing with Iraq. But remember, Halliburton was dealing with Iraq at a time when it was permissible to deal with them. There was a gray period when it ought not to have been dealing with them, but it went on and continued to do so. But I'm not certain that that is a contradiction. I think that there is a possibility, and Americans ought to be concerned about it, that this clique in Washington, of which Woolsey is a part, that is trying to get us into a war with Iraq, is looking on Iraq's oil supplies as something they would like to possess. And therefore, you have to look at the connections of all the people in the administration, the Bush administration, to oil. Cheney has connections to oil, so does Bush, and so do many others. Iraq has probably the richest oil fields in the world, and they've never been exploited.
I'm looking at a piece by Jeffrey Gray called Dick Cheney's Pipe Dream. And it says American Special Forces troops may have begun moving on Afghanistan late this week, but American special interests started jockeying for position in the region years before, then focusing on Dick Cheney talking about the landlocked nation of Afghanistan, key to exploiting the nearby oil reserves of the Caspian Sea. The man who would one day help conduct a war in Central Asia told a 1998 crowd at the right-wing Cato Institute about the black gold that lay beneath the waters there and the importance of teasing it from the politically volatile countries. The good Lord didn't see fit to put oil and gas only where there are democratic regimes friendly to the United States, Cheney said. He condemned the U.S. sanctions placed on potentially oil-rich countries like Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, and Libya. You've got to go where the oil is, he told another audience that year. Halliburton has continued to do just that, and it talks about how Cheney sold his Halliburton shares after taking office, accepted a resigning bonus of close to $1.5 million and over $13 million in stock with more in options. It looks like, as we talk about the oiligarchy with President Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, closely associated with Chevron on its board of directors, has an oil tanker named after her, that's exactly what Cheney is doing right now.
Well, it's not. And then Brent Stolfoff also is involved, and James Baker is also involved through the Carlyle Corporation. They're obviously, are these tie-ins between the administration and the oil of the area, not only the oil of the Caspian, which you just spoke about, but the oil of the Gulf. The big question that Americans ought to be confronting is how far are they willing to go? Is the Bush administration willing to risk all of the consequences that would ensue from an invasion of Iraq in order to get their hands on that oil? That's a big question.
Well, I'd like to ask you, in terms of that, assuming that the administration does move forward with this direct attempt to overthrow Saddam, as it continues to be hinted at, or at least the trial balloons are appearing in newspapers every day, doesn't the administration actually risk losing even more in terms of possible popular uprisings in places like Saudi Arabia? And increased antagonism in other among the general population in other Arab countries that have rich oil deposits?
Of course it does. It's not only Arab countries. It's also Iran. In order to make this invasion, we'd have to jump off from Turkey. Iran looks on Turkey as a NATO country. Iran is very apprehensive that it's going to be caught in a pincers. Americans in Afghanistan on one side, NATO troops in Iraq on the other. So Iran will move immediately toward the Iraqis as this thing begins to develop. As for the Arab people, I think that this business of the Arab people revolting against their leaders is overdone. The Egyptians and the Saudis have the ability to suppress their people. They have enormously competent and powerful repressive apparatus, which they can immediately put into use should there be any signs of a revolt. What is unfortunate, though, for the people of those countries is that if these nations, the Saudis and the Egyptians, do back a U.S. move against Iraq, what little legitimacy they have left with their people will completely disappear. There's very little legitimacy now, as I see it. But if the United States goes ahead and invades, the Egyptians and the Saudis will effectively sign off their government as absolutely worthless.
Why is the United States going after Iraq when in Saudi Arabia, for example, you have a government that has not cooperated with the investigations of the hijackers? 15 of them were Saudi. And what is the U.S. relationship with the Bush administration relationship, the Bush family relationship with the Saudi royal family when it comes to oil?
Now, you're getting at what really is involved here. The Saudi relationship with the United States is based on arms procurement. The Saudis buy enormous amounts of arms from the United States, and as a consequence, they have come to be a mainstay of the arms munitions industry in the United States. And it's that connection that the United States and administrations like the Bush administration have to preserve. So you're right when you say that there is a connection between the Saudis and the Bush family. But I think that isn't the reason why the Bushes are bending over backwards to oblige the Saudis and try to work with them. What's really at stake are these enormous arms contracts and billions and billions of dollars which support companies like Raytheon and Boeing and you name them.
The Carlyle Group?
The Carlyle Group.
What about the Carlyle Group and who it is?
So the Carlyle Group, as I understand it, is a shadowy group, shadowy in the sense that we don't get as much information on it as we ought to be getting. But one of the areas it's very definitely into is arms production. And the Saudis are a member of the Carlyle Group. And as I mentioned a while ago, so are some very prominent Texans.
In terms of the economics of oil. Clearly, I mean, the Middle East is not as central a producer of oil worldwide as it used to be. Why does the United States feel the need to control the Mideast oil so strongly?
All right. What is going on here is this. Back in the 30s, the cartel, the big oil cartel, shifted the center of gravity to the Middle East, actually to the Gulf. It was the premier producer of oil. As a consequence, the Middle East, and specifically the Persian Gulf, has the ability to influence, through OPEC, oil prices. Because the Saudis have the most up-to-date oil facilities in the world, they can, by turning those facilities on and off, compensate for shortfalls in production worldwide or kick up their production. As a consequence, they control the price. It's not that the United States couldn't do without the Saudis. It's that the oil system would not function if the Saudis were to stand apart and to begin to obstruct. Because make no bones about it, the Saudis control OPEC.
Stephen Pelletier, I want to thank you for being with us, Professor Emeritus at the U.S. Army War College, author of Iraq and the International Oil System. That does it for the program, Democracy Now!, produced by Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. We're broadcasting from Downtown Community Television. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hey, Mr. Greedy, you must learn to satisfy. Hey, Brother Longer, where is your bay? Brother, just pray and wait, Lord. Wrong is wrong. Wrong can't be better. Someone on your brethren, I understand it hurts your feelings, but once they shoot me, I'll say relax, it's best to chop it with an axe. I say forgive him, oh you won't be forgiven. Ooh, wrong is wrong, wrong can be better.
Hello?
Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. We just want to do a little test here.
Sure.
Okay. So just talk normally.
I'll talk about the weather here. The weather here is very good. It's sunny. We had a lot of bad weather yesterday. We had, actually for us, good, because we need rain, and we had rain all day.
So when you was talking to us, did you change phones?
Yeah. This is a different phone now.
Oh, I see. Okay.
What was the other kind of phone you were on?
Well, all the phones in this house are similar phones, but it's just the one that was in my bedroom.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Me a disc of what it.
Okay.
And can you send me the Woolsey disc, too?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Okay,
good.
Thanks.
Thank you.